Please report to the council. My name is Sarah Newell. I'm the attorney with the Nebraska Commission on Public Advocacy. I represent Jason Custer in this appeal. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes. Mr. Custer submits that the trial court erred in a number of ways, most poignant of which is by instructing the jury based on the pattern jury instruction NJI 2nd from 4.0 rather than the language of the statute alone with regard to the definition of premeditation, because doing so violates the Nebraska Constitution Separation of Powers Clause. He also submits that the court erred in refusing to instruct on his choice of evils defense with regard to felon possession of a firearm, and we also submit that there was insufficient evidence to support the conviction. With regard to the premeditation issue, as the court is aware, the court here instructed the jury on using, on the issue of definition of premeditation, using the NJI 2nd Crim 4.0 definition.
Is it your contention that in so doing, the trial court added an element? Because as you brief it, you're comparing it to the Burleson analysis and so forth.
I think that they confuse an element, and by giving the instantaneous, by adding the instantaneous language, that what the court is doing is sort of subsuming all of the different lesser-included offenses or co-equal offenses. The distinction between first-degree murder, second-degree murder, and manslaughter is a matter of premeditation with regard to first versus second, and then intentional is the same with regard to second versus manslaughter. The difference between second and manslaughter is whether or not you're upon a sudden provocation. All of these definitions we submit are intertwined, and by convoluting the language, conflating instantaneous and simultaneous, you're really undermining the definition and muddying the water such that the jury can't make an informed decision.
So is that an argument that the instruction is confusing, or do you maintain nevertheless that this is a breach of the separation of powers?
I would submit both. I think that the problem with the instruction is that it is confusing and it subsumes and conflates all of the different levels of murder. And I think it is also problematic because, the confusion causes the jury to not be able to distinguish between those things. And when the court incorrectly defines an element when a correct definition is requested, that is prejudicial error in and of itself. The separation of powers issue comes into play in the sense that the legislature in 1977 amended, or didn't even amend, there was prior to 77 no definition of premeditation. In 1977, the court or the legislature adopted the definition of premeditation that was simply the language in 2830.302, a design form to do something before it is done. The instantaneous language was added based on language from cases originating in 1901 and 1895, which is Savory versus State and Carlton versus State. The problem with those two cases is that those cases, before the legislature adopted the definition, they included all the definitions that were used in jury instructions back at that time were the district court's own interpretation of what the law was based on the case law. In both Savory versus State and in Carlton, the court gives directly contradictory directions or instructions, basically including the language that it has to happen before the act, but it says specifically before or at the time the blow is struck or the fatal shot is fired. That specific language is in both in Carlton and Savory, which is the basis for the instantaneous language that was added in NJI and has been adopted and kind of permeated throughout the years. I would submit to you that the reason why the court or why the legislature adopted a specific, more narrow definition in 1977 is because of this inflation and this confusion that occurred in both Carlton and Savory. But as I indicated in my brief, the difficulty with the language regarding instantaneousness, and just for the court's clarification, NJI adds specifically, that the provocation or that the, hold on a second, I'm sorry, I apologize. Okay, so NJI says premeditation, that is forming the intent to act before acting, which is largely consistent with the statute. Time needed for premeditation may be so short as to be instantaneous, provided that the intent to act is formed before the act and not simultaneously with the act. The problem is that this language saying that it may be so short as to be instantaneous, instantaneous is synonymous with simultaneous. And that is punctuated by the example that the county or the attorney general gave in this case in closing. And it's something that is commonly used in these types of cases where they say, as you're going under a stop sign or under a stoplight, if the light changes just as you're under it, you still chose to go through it.
Is instantaneous qualified in NJI?
It is, in the sense that, well, I don't I don't know that I'm comfortable saying that it's qualified. I think that it remains contradictory. I mean, on the one hand, you're saying it has to be before the act, but you're also saying it can be instantaneous with the act. So that is where the confusion comes in, and that is the exact same problem that, that occurred in both Savory and Carlton, where the court specifically said before or at the time the blow is struck. Well, before or at the time is, before is clearly different than at the time. At the time is instantaneous, simultaneous. That's why the problem arises. Because on the one hand, the statute is very clear, and it purely says a design formed to do something, or a design formed to do something before it is done. The state can always argue that the
before. So would it have to be a second or a minute before, or?
I don't think that it needs to be a specific time frame, but I think that that's why the legislature said simply before it is done. Because before it is done can be a second. It can be anything. Those are arguments that the state can make during closing. And those are things that the jury can decide. I think it's a jury issue that the jury should determine what before it is done means. When you include the instantaneous language, all you're doing is muddying the waters and confusing the jury and conflating concepts that are already very complicated. In our homicide statutes, the problem that we have, as you well know, because you've been wrestling with it for a number of years, is how do you define the difference between premeditated, malice, and intentional but not premeditated, and intentional but upon a sudden quarrel or unlawful act? These things are complicated enough to then muddy the waters further by including this instantaneous language that is confusing, and quite frankly, the jurors don't know what it means. And this is a precise. This case is a precise example of why this is a problem. If you look back at State v. Trice, there's very similar facts in terms of a fight occurring and not really clear, you know, two different versions of the facts. Who do you believe? And in Trice, the court said that it was muddy enough that you have to give the sudden quarrel definition, and you have to let the jury consider those things. And here, the judge did give a sudden quarrel definition, but the problem is that it's not clear when you include this before or at the time type of language what the jury understood and what they thought they were doing. With regard to the same issue, I want to address the point of legislative acquiescence, which was raised in the state's brief. I think the best guide for how the court should determine this issue is State v. Burleson, and I know that this court hates to even talk about State v. Burleson, but what happened in Burleson is that this court had for a number of years, or for a measure of time, decided that malice was an element in second-degree murder and interpreted the statutes accordingly. And as the court continued to wrestle with these issues, they decided to go with a strict interpretation of the statute and saying, you know what, in 1977, the Supreme Court or the legislature modified the homicide statutes and eliminated malice from the definition of second-degree murder. And therefore, we have to respect that decision to omit that language and interpret the language of the statute under its plain, direct, and unambiguous
meaning. Well, that kind of takes me back to my first question, because I think that essence of that problem was adding an element.
And I would submit to you that the mens rea is an element, and the mens rea is the only thing that distinguishes between first degree, second degree, and manslaughter. And so, therefore, if you are conflating those definitions and confusing those issues, I think you are messing with an element.
But what do you define mens rea as you use it in your argument?
I'm sorry.
What do you define mens rea as in your argument?
Well, I guess to go back to law school, mens rea is the intent necessary to premise the crime. First-degree murder requires premeditation.
A planning of it first.
Well, a decision before it is done, rather than at the time that it is done. Again, going back to that streetlight example, it's one thing to decide to run the red light when you're at if you're yellow light, when you go under it, you're at the crosswalk and it's yellow. It's another thing for it to turn red right when you're under it, because that is instantaneous with the act. And that is, I think, the problem with this particular definition, because when you're saying instantaneous, most jurors aren't legal scholars. And that's, I think, very confusing. And then when you look at Savory and Carlton, you're seeing that even legal scholars are having a problem with this issue.
What was the evidence that was used to establish premeditation in this case that could, in your opinion, a problem for the jury?
The problem in this case is that the state had a variety of different theories that they were going off of. The state's primary theory was that this was a cold-blooded, premeditated murder. At one point, they even argued that he sat outside the house watching them. There's absolutely no evidence in the record to support that, but that was their theory. My client's theory, version of events, was that he went to the house thinking that the victim was gone, thinking that he could work things out with Cyrus, who was the owner of the home, who had said at a previous time, "It's not his money anyway, work it out with me, we'll be fine." So he went over to the house thinking that he could work it out with Cyrus with the victim being gone. He shows up and realizes that Cyrus is there, the victim is there, and another guy is there. There is a significant size discrepancy between my client and the victim, in the sense of a couple inches. My guy's a lot taller. And so he feels when he sees these three people, and he's been told that he's gone, that he's been set up. So he gets out of the car, brings the gun that he sees in the back seat at the last minute underneath his coat, because although the victim had been aggressive to he and his friend, had showed up at their home with a friend who aggressively previously, had been texting him obviously very militant messages saying he was going to gut him like a fish and slice him up and fuck him like he'd never been fucked before, for lack of a better phrase, and also had rushed at them with a knife potentially in an alleyway previously, he thought he could still work it out, because on that particular incident he was able to talk down the victim and kind of smooth things over. So he approached them hoping that he could smooth things over, and instead the victim, according to my client, rushes at him with a knife and says, "I'll finish it." And that is the moment where he drew the gun and shot him in the leg. Which actually brings me to the insufficiency of the evidence argument. I know that insufficiency is not something that usually receives a lot of talk in this venue, but in this case, although the state submits that the court has to indulge the facts, I mean, you always have to indulge facts to the extent that it benefits the state, but there is a very significant contradiction in the evidence here. And I want to show you exhibits 81 and 82, just to kind of give some idea.
Tell you, counsel, we can't see what it did. Can't
okay.
see it.
I think I can explain the gist of what I'm talking about here. This is the house, this is the driveway, and what the markings on here denote where my client was at the time of the shooting. My client pulls up the street right around here. One witness says that my client was here and the victim was here when he shot him. Staying here the same time, both shots. One bullet is found over here, another bullet is found lodged in the Jeep. It is absolutely physically impossible for someone to shoot from here at a person here, hit him in the leg or the chest, and have the bullet lodged in the Jeep. The other person, Cyrus, says the exact, largely the same thing. He says that my client was first here when he shot him, which could account for the leg injury. This is the victim, this is my client. Shooting him in the leg, but the bullet isn't lodged in the house. The bullet is found in the yard. The second shot, again, is lodged, or at least some shot, is lodged in the Jeep. There's no way that a person can be standing here, shooting at a man here, and lodged in the Jeep. It is physically impossible.
So what is your point, that he didn't shoot him?
No, I can't rightfully dispute that he shot him. And my client doesn't. My client's testimony was that when he approached, I'll use the graphic to give you a little bit of an idea, that as he approached, he walked up the sidewalk, parked back here on the street, and he walks up the sidewalk, or walks up the driveway, and right around here is where the Adam starts to rush at him. He says that Adam starts to rush at him, he shoots him, he keeps coming, and then as Adam approaches him, victim approaches him, he kind of jumps to the side and shoots in a downward angle, which is the only way that you can get a bullet lodged in the side of the Jeep here, is if he's somewhere in the yard. Because there's no...
And what, he's right-handed?
My client is right-handed. He had the gun under his left arm. I think he said he shot kind of with the left hand, or honestly, I can't recall which... And he said he shot him with.
The bullet was in the passenger side or the driver's side?
The bullet is in the passenger side of the Jeep. Okay. So this is the Jeep and this is... Sorry. The Jeep is depicted here in the driveway. This is the actual shot of the Jeep, and I know this picture is awful, but you can see right here that this is where the bullet is lodged. So it's, again, it's absolutely physically impossible for someone to be at the end of the driveway off the shot over here and lodge a bullet there if you're aiming at someone who's standing around here on the sidewalk.
So the point of which is that physical, some physical evidence is inconsistent with those two witnesses.
Absolutely. All of the physical evidence is inconsistent with those two witnesses. And so, although you do indulge the state's evidence, the evidence that the state is presenting is inconsistent. And the physical evidence actually supports what my client says, which supports the idea that that you really need to know when he formed the intent to shoot. He says that he formed the intent to shoot as he was rushing at him, whereas the state is saying that he formed the intent to shoot when he was standing in the street and shot him from there. But that's impossible. And I see that I'm eating into my rebuttal time, so unless there's any additional questions right now, I think I'll sit down and I'll address further issues later.
Thank you very much. Ms. Vincent, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Ms. Vincent. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the appellee, the state of Nebraska. Custer has alleged several errors in his brief. However, my argument will focus primarily on two, the jury instructions and the prosecutorial misconduct. But before I get started on that, I think I should probably briefly the point that Ms. Norman about the evidence. My understanding of the evidence is that when Custer got out of the car, he had the rifle concealed on him. Josh Wright was in the yard, and he immediately dropped down, put his hands up. He's staring at Custer. He sees him walk up onto the curb. Leal and McCormick are up toward the residence. Leal is preparing to take McCormick home, and McCormick is on his way over to the Jeep. He's walking that direction. He's not looking at Custer. He's not aware that he's there. And as he approaches the Jeep, he gets shot in the leg, and then he doubles over. And as he's leaned over, that's when Custer advanced on him and shot him a second time and hit him under the armpit, and it went at a downward trajectory and launched him past the door. So I think the state did, in its closing argument,
it lodged where, ultimately?
It lodged in the passenger side door.
That's the second bullet.
Yeah, the second bullet. Right. So he was bent over. It was consistent. The state did provide an adequate explanation. And again, I don't think know what the equivalent. As to the instructions, the jury instructions, Custer claims the district court erred in refusing to give his proposed instruction regarding the definition of premeditation. We disagree. The definition given by the district court was taken from the Nebraska jury instructions and is consistent with this court's case law. Moreover, the statute upon which Custer relies has remained unchanged for nearly 40 years, which means the legislature has clearly acquiesced in this court's interpretation of it. And finally, this court rejected the same claim as State v. Taylor in 2011, and we submit that the rationale underlying that decision is equally applicable here. As far as the...
Well, opposing counsel puts emphasis on the NJI use of the word instantaneous. And my same question that I was asking is it, in your view, is instantaneous qualified?
It is qualified, and I don't think it's a synonym for simultaneous. Instantaneous means quickly or rapidly, something that can happen right away. Simultaneous means at the same time. So I don't think that they're synonyms, and I think it is definitely, to the extent that there might be some confusion there, it's definitely qualified because it says it instantaneous.
It says not instantaneous provided that the intent to act is formed before the act.
And not simultaneous.
And not simultaneous.
Right.
What was McCormick doing when he was first shot? Walking toward the Jeep.
Yeah.
And was there any evidence that he ever made an advance toward the defendant?
The defendant's testimony.
That's the...
That is it.
Okay.
And the other,
And the other evidence says the defendant approached McCormick closer and then shot him through the armpit, and then the bullet lodged in the Jeep's passenger side.
Right. Leal was behind him, as I understand it. They're walking toward the Jeep. Leal's following. He sees Custer as he gets out of the car and comes up.
So he couldn't have made the shot on McCormick unless he moved it to a different position.
Right, right. And
so
I think
he had to be to the right of McCormick at some instance because McCormick was between the Jeep and the defendant.
Right, okay. Right. And I think there was a bit of a discrepancy between the right and Leal's that as far as when Custer advanced, if he fired a second shot, and I would submit to you that it's probably the most likely explanation since the muzzle of the gun was less than 40.
Is it your position that that's the evidence of premeditation when he advanced again and fired the second shot?
Well, I think that's part of it, but I think there's sufficient evidence to suggest that he actually had that plan in mind by the time he showed up there. I mean, you have him getting out and have this growing hostilities between the two of them. The night before, they were supposed to meet at the park and slug it out. Cormick stood him up. He's upset. They go back. There's a discussion about a firearm. And then that following morning, there's a text message from Davis to Custer about, hey, give that gun back. So I think that shows that he was aware of the gun and he had access to it. And then, of course, he initiates the contact with Cormick at 10:30 on November 2nd. That was the first time that there was a contact. And then in the hour preceding shooting, you've got, he's repeatedly expressing a desire to meet with McCormick and to quote-unquote finish this. And then, of course, when he pulls up in front of the house, he gets out, he leaves the engine running, the doors open, the lights are on, which suggests that he was looking for a quick getaway. He didn't plan on being there long.
So your position is this wasn't an instantaneous plan, premeditation.
Right.
That it was thought out and the evidence would support that it was more than just a flash of a second or a mere second.
Exactly.
Which the defendant developed a plan to kill.
Right.
Okay.
Which is contrary to the defendant's testimony.
Yes.
His testimony is to the effect that the victim approached him with a knife, and then things ensued.
Yeah. His testimony was that he, you know, Adam said, I'm going to settle this, and started running toward him. He shot him in the leg, and he still at him like some kind of a crazed animal.
And he got a self-defense instruction.
Yes, and the jury rejected.
And where was the knife found, or was the knife found?
In his pocket. It was in his front pocket. It was just a pocket knife. It was all the way down in the front pocket. There was no evidence of any knives or anything found anywhere. But I guess with respect to the Burleson analysis, I would submit to you that that's inapplicable. That there's a finding a term in a statute and adding an element to a statutory offense. One is statutory interpretation, which is impermissible. The other is judicial legislation, which is not. Custer also claims the district court refusing to instruct the jury on the choice of Siebel's offense, and we disagree. Before addressing the merits, I just want to make a couple of points. Whether choice of Siebel's is a viable defense to felon in possession remains a question. Because in Newell, this court assumed without deciding that it was available but found it wasn't supported by the facts. And second, the instruction at issue is not part of the record on appeal. One of the things the customer must show is that his proposed instruction was a correct statement of the law. We have no way of determining whether it was. But even if we assume the instruction, or even if we assume that it was, the instruction was not warranted by the evidence. The relevant choice confronting Custer was not whether to approach McCormick. It was whether to approach him at all. Custer was not obligated to confront McCormick. He could have easily driven away without incident, an option that can hardly be characterized as an evil. But additionally, during his testimony, Custer repeatedly stated that he was not expecting to find McCormick at Leal's, and upon seeing him, immediately suspicion that he was being set up, some sort of ambush. So instead of leaving to avoid the situation, he scrounged up a weapon and then got out of the truck and walked right in. That circumstance alone renders this defense inapplicable. Custer was under no guard. He cannot consciously and deliberately place himself in danger and then claim that he has a firearm. In other words, he can't create the situation that necessitated his possession of a firearm, which is exactly what he did. The defense was factually unavailable, and the court correctly refused the instruction. Custer also claims the prosecutor committed misconduct during closing arguments by commenting on his failure to report the shooting to the police and by stating that he wrapped his story around the forensics. His claim, however, has been waived. Custer was represented by two attorneys at trial, neither of whom objected to the statements at issue or any of the testimony on which those statements were based. Under Nebraska law, failure to object or move for this trial constitutes a waiver. And to the extent he seeks to skirt that waiver by claiming the prosecutor's statements amounted to plain error, we disagree. The statements regarding Custer's failure to call the police were clearly addressed in the period after the shooting, but before he was arrested and presumably given Miranda warnings. Both this court and the U.S. Supreme Court have held that a defendant may be impeached should be arrest silence without violating due process, such that those statements were proper. The remaining statements that Custer wrapped his story around the forensics after having 15 months to review the evidence, after hearing all of the trial testimony, were legitimate attacks on Custer's credibility as a witness.
I think some of the arguments addressed to post-arrest silence, isn't it?
No. No, the statement about the police, because when he questioned him, and I didn't set that part of the exchange out in my brief, but I think it occurs after that section. The prosecutor was asking him, okay, you've just shot him. You've heard, you know that he's hurt. You're in this life and death struggle. Hear the sirens. See the police in your neighborhood. You know they're looking for you. So, did you call the police then? He was asking him, at what point did you call the police? But the state never got into, were you, after he was arrested. I mean, they stopped right when they got to the point, well, he was arrested at the motel room at 8:30. After that, there were no questions about, well, did you try to question him? Did you give him Miranda warnings? He was never asked whether they attempted to question him. There's just no evidence that he was ever given Miranda warnings or that they're referring to any point in time after, right after the shooting. So I don't think there's any.
And what's the state's argument with respect to the prosecutor's comments about you've had 15 months to develop your remarks?
Well, it's clear from the record that Custer staked his credibility on the forensic evidence. During closing, his attorney argued that he was adequately explain it. On rebuttal, the state, of course, disagreed and pointed out that Custer's claim should be regarded with some suspicion for a couple of reasons. One, he had access to this several months prior to trial, and two, he sat through everyone's testimony. Now, those statements are similar to statements that this court found permissible, State v. Jacob and State v. Nesbitt, and similarly, the U.S. Supreme Court has held that a prosecutor may, during closing arguments, comment on the fact that a defendant was present in the courtroom during trial and thus had a unique opportunity to give his testimony. As the prosecutor's comments were directed at Custer's credibility, they were proper. There was no misconduct.
Is there a distinction between tailoring testimony to evidence at trial as distinguished from tailoring testimony to pretrial evidence, forensics, and so forth?
I don't believe so. And the key to Doyle, as I understand it, is you can't make reference to the fact that this person fell. Hey, why didn't you tell the story long ago? Had a chance. How come you never told the police that this was self-defense? I'm not making that comment if you're just pointing out that, hey, look, this person's had ample time to, you know, conform their statement, evidence that they've had. Plus, they've had the advantage of hearing everybody else testify. So you can go up there and make sure that your statements match. And there's a lengthy discussion about that in that Agar decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. Attack on credibility was here.
But your argument, nevertheless, was this was not objected to at trial?
No, it wasn't, and it doesn't rise to the level of plain error. Well, we submit there wasn't error at all, but even if it was, it certainly was plain error. Finally, I guess I should note that the state submits that the district court committed plain error allocation of credit for reserves, and that its order should be modified to that credit applies only to count two. And subject to that slight modification, we would ask the judge. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 4 minutes and 16 seconds, Ms. Newell.
I'd like to begin by returning to the premeditation issue. And to clarify my response to your earlier question, Judge Miller-Lerman, I think there are two separate issues going on with the premeditation problem. One is the fact that the language is confusing and it's contradictory. Even if it's qualified, it remains confusing, and that is problematic because it does relate to an essential element. The other big problem is that adding that language is a violation of the Separation of Powers Clause. Nebraska has a separate Separation of Powers Clause that is protected more, or is guarded more closely than other jurisdictions. The problem here is that what the court is doing by adding that language and interpreting or giving more information beyond the statutory definition is that they are usurping the power of the legislature to define that element. The legislature had the opportunity to maintain that language. What's interesting is premeditation is the only definition that relates to first-degree murder that is actually enshrined in statute. The other elements, the other definitions are not in statute. And I would submit to you that the reason why that is the only definition that is in statute and has been codified is because of the confusing language in Carlton and Savory, and that the court or the legislature wanted to make it clear and simple and leave it with just that language. Yes, the court or the legislature could have amended that language, but just like in Burleson, it is absurd to expect the legislature to modify existing language to say, no, really, we meant it when we adopted it the first time. That is essentially what the state is saying needed to happen here, is that after this court interpreted this language in a more broad sense, the legislature should have come back and said, no, we weren't kidding, we really meant just the language that we adopted. The same thing in Burleson. In Burleson, the court, the legislature could have come back and modified that language immediately to address those malice issues, but they didn't.
Do you know if the source of that language is the Uniform Criminal Act?
Which language are you referring to?
The definition.
The definition in statute, I don't follow offhand. When I look at the legislative history, there wasn't significant discussion about that section. What is interesting, though, is that it is the only definition that was codified. Malice is not codified. Sudden quarrel isn't codified. Deliberately isn't codified. Purposefully isn't codified. All of those other definitions, we rely on the court's interpretations. And yet the legislature singled out this one definition to narrow the definition and not adopt that
well,
which
that,
was being used.
That's what I'm trying to clarify, because I heard you to say it was this definition was done to cure Carlton and...
That is my theory. I don't have anything in the legislative history to indicate that. I would also indicate that I would submit that the language is plain, direct, and unambiguous and not subject to interpretation, and therefore we don't even look at the legislative history, because language is what it is. To quote Professor Works in law school, this is it, there ain't no more. I think that that's all you have to look at, and I think it stands by itself. With regard to I want to submit one other thing with regard to the delegation of powers or separation of powers issue. To rely so heavily on the NJI definition also improperly delegates powers to a committee of attorneys that are not a legislative body. They don't have any real authority to legislate. And by the court adhering so strongly to the NJI definition, I think that that also is a separation of powers issue. With regard to the specific facts of this case, I want to just emphasize a few more things. The state's theory is physically impossible. There's no way for someone to be standing here or here and shoot at a person here and lodge a bullet here. It's physically impossible. The state's explanation that Custer advanced and then shot Adam while he was kneeling down, that still doesn't explain how the bullet ends up in the truck. There's no way for the bullet to take a right turn or a left turn and magically end up in the side of the Jeep. Also, with regard to things that support Custer's story, the state's witnesses testify that Custer, or that McCormick and Leal were in the process of walking to the car to go home. What they forget, though, is that McCormick had gone to get his dogs earlier in the night, and the dogs were still in the house. If McCormick and Leo were actually getting ready to leave, if I may just finish this thought, then the dogs wouldn't be in the house. The dogs would be in the car. So that undermines their testimony as well. Again, the bullets are found in two different locations. There's no way that someone can be shooting from essentially the same spot or precisely the same spot as the other individual indicated. Wright indicated that all the shots came from the exact same place. And so there's no way that the bullets can be lodged in two different locations, and especially lodged in a Jeep that's up here, if Adam is off to the side of the Jeep.
If the defendant doesn't move.
The defendant has to move into the yard. He has to be over here somewhere to get the bullet into the Jeep. And no one indicated in any way that he was even remotely over here. Everyone says he stays by the street. There's no way for that to happen unless what he is saying is accurate, that he walks up the driveway, and as they advance, then they moved into the yard. That is the only way for that bullet to end up in the Jeep. And so that is the reason why the court should consider that there is insufficient evidence to support the conviction in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. That takes us to the next case of the day, which is State versus Victor L. Carter.